Christopher D. Bryan, attorney registration number 35522, representing defendant appellant Preston and Betty Hinn. We're here today in an interlocutory appeal concerning whether or not the trial court improvidently granted a preliminary injunction to the appellee Westpac enjoining Mr. and Mrs. Hinn from erecting a gate that restricted access across their front yard near the base of Aspen Mountain. Now, the standard of review here is de novo because it is interlocutory in scope and is concerned primarily legal issues. The trial court ruled that Westpac established all six prongs of Rathke sufficient for the extraordinary relief of a CRCP 65 preliminary injunction. We appeal those findings and ask for this court to send directions back to the trial court to dissolve the preliminary injunction. First and foremost of the Rathke prongs is reasonable probability of success on the merits, and that is whether Westpac could prove that it had a reasonable probability of success of establishing that a prescriptive easement allowed it to use about 7% of the Hinn's overall square footage and 25% of their front yard to access their lot. Now, these lots have been reconfigured, and I put in a schematic graph of that in the opening brief that shows the replatting after a 1984 exception and then a replatting of the development of the residences at Little Nell after 2005. The trial court found that a prescriptive easement had existed from 1962 until 2005. It is our contention, as it was below at the preliminary injunction hearing of summer of 2009, that the prescriptive easement, if any, existed, and we do contest whether there was adversity for a lot of that period, but presuming for the sake of argument that it did exist, we contend that the prescriptive easement was extinguished by merger in 1989. That is when Dr. Yarbrough, who owned Lot 5, as it's presently constituted, as it was then constituted, and then his wife, and he took as joint tenants Lot 6, which is the dominant estate. For about a four-month period, there was that coextensive ownership. And I'm happy to parse some of the case law that has been throughout the briefs, because it's very important, because this is an issue of first impression in Colorado. This has not been determined as to whether prescriptive easement can be extinguished by merger, where there's sole ownership of the serving estate and joint tenancy of the dominant estate. We contend that the interests were coextensive enough in accordance with the restatement and in accordance with other case law from other jurisdictions, so that there was an effective extinguishment by merger of the prescriptive easement. Salazar is the leading case in Colorado as to this issue, but it did not get to the very close point that we have to consider here. And Salazar provided that the easement terminates to the extent that the ownership of the estate permits the uses authorized by the easement. Now, nowhere does it say that the deed has to be identical as to...
Excuse me, but Salazar was not an easement case.
You're right, sir. But we are talking about the extinguishment concern.
All right, but in that case, it was a boundary or a boundary fence.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But it's the same concept that will illustrate why we need further development of this law in Colorado here. Allen v. Nickerson, which is a decision by this court, holds that a party cannot adversely use his or her own property. Based on those principles, it would make no sense for the prescriptive easement to continue while Dr. Yarbrough had sole ownership of the serving estate and then joint tenancy of the dominant estate.
But in terms of complete unity of title, we don't have that here, isn't that right? And does that make a difference?
It does make a difference, and yes, you don't have verbatim identical names on both deeds or titles. But that's not where the analysis stops. Cheever is the case from Massachusetts that the trial court relied on primarily. There, the court said that the ownership must be coextensive. It went short of saying that it had to be identical, that the names had to be identical. It said coextensive. And then if you parse that, the reasoning of the court there, it said that the deeds to both properties don't have to be verbatim. Instead, it turned into scope, ownership, dominion, and control. And Cheever focuses on what happens when a person holds one, and this is the language that it quotes, one estate in severalty, and then only a fractional part of the other. Now it's necessary for us to go back to Colorado law in 2004 in Taylor v. Canterbury, the Supreme Court of this state, defined joint tenancy as a form of ownership in which each joint tenant possesses the entire estate rather than a fractional share. Now that's important because that distinguishes it from a tenancy in common. A tenancy in common is a form of ownership in which each co-tenant owns a separate fractional share. That's also from Taylor. The cases that are cited in the briefs by Westpac.
Well, let me sure. You say a separate fractional share. They, in a tenancy in common, they own a fractional share of the entirety, though, do they not?
Yes.
And,
that is correct.
And so it might be 90-10 or it might be 50-50, but they are both owners of the, at least partial owners of the entirety.
Yes.
Why doesn't that apply here?
It's our contention, Your Honor, that the distinction has to be made between a joint tenancy and a tenancy in common, because a tenancy in common is one in which someone can alienate their own interest. They can encumber that interest. They can do things with that interest that they cannot do within a joint tenancy.
Why can't you do that in a joint tenancy? I mean, you won't preserve the joint tenancy. You'll dissolve the joint tenancy, but you, as a joint tenant, you can alienate your interest, can you not?
Correct, and that's what Taylor v. Canterbury stands for. And when you do that, when you alienate, you do destroy the joint tenancy so that it converts to a tenancy in common. And that would allow for adverse use to start over. The reason that we have to parse the...
Is it a tenancy in common or a tenancy by the entirety?
Well, Colorado law does not observe or recognize tenancy by the entirety. Some of the other cases talk about tenancy by the entirety, and that's different as well. But a tenancy in common is fine here. If that had happened, then one of the other co-tenants could have established their adverse use to the prescriptive easement such that the prescriptive easement would start anew. But because of the factual situation, which is unique from all the other cases we've looked at here, there is a need to focus on whether or not Dr. Yarbrough had dominion and control, which he did, and possession of both estates, dominant and servient, lot 6 and lot 5. And he did. We know he did because he himself granted two ski easements to the city of Aspen. He himself obtained a construction access easement. He himself did things that are inconsistent with the observation of a prescriptive easement. And the tenancies by the entireties, which don't apply in Colorado, but are important for us to distinguish the other cases, turn more on factual issues than they do the titling as a tenancy by the entirety. For example, in Lacey...
Let me ask you this. If Dr. Yarbrough was a joint tenant in lot 4, or when we our numbers are all odd, but it was number 4, I guess.
In the Serbian estate?
The Serbian estate was 5, right?
That's right, so lot 6.
Okay, lot 6, the dominant estate. If he was a joint tenant there, and someone else was the owner of lot 5, could Dr. Yarbrough alone, without Mrs. Yarbrough, could he have given up the easement without Ms. Yarbrough's consent?
I think that he could have abandoned that. It would be a factual determination as to whether that was representative of what her position was as to the use of the adverse prescriptive easement. To the extent that it was an abandonment or a renunciation of it, then there might be some agency concerns as to whether that would apply to her adverse use, if any.
He have conveyed it back. So basically, in a document conveying the easement, could he have released the easement and bind Mrs. Yarbrough?
That's a factual information that I'm not sure I can answer right now, Your Honor. But it is important to note that this was a prescriptive easement that had not been reduced to record. It had not been an express easement. No one had argued that it was an express easement at this time. Or that it was even a prescriptive easement. And that goes to why we believe that the prescriptive easement never really vested in the first place, because throughout the 42 years of supposedly adverse prescriptive easement, it was permissive. All of these people lived very close to each other and were using this one trail to access the mountain in their houses, and it was by a neighborly indulgence, by permission. So we believe that the court erred primarily by finding there was a prescriptive easement in the first place, and second of all, by finding that there was not an extinguishment in 1989 for that 4 month of overlap where Dr. Yarbrough had dominion and control over both lots, such that the prescriptive easement wouldn't need the line anymore.
And in the trial court, did you contest that it was a prescriptive easement based on permissive?
Yes, Your Honor, we argued that the other sections in our brief, which are made part of the record, as to the neighborly indulgence and the permission.
And the way you framed it on appeal, also, you're asking us to decide whether it was permissive or whether the court heard in concluding that it was permissive, it was not permissive.
Yes, Your Honor, that's one of our bases, albeit a secondary basis for our asking your court to find that there was not a prescriptive easement, therefore there was not reasonable success of the merits. And I would like to say the balance of my time to rebuttal, but I would say that there are other things that we've raised in the briefs as to why Rathke doesn't apply. There wasn't other adequate remedy at law. Westpac could have sued RLND under breach of contract. They chose not to for whatever reason, and instead hope to take property from Mr. and Mrs. Hinn to use as prescriptive easement. And then there's also the issue of irreparable injury. When this 1984 law was split, when 4 and 6 were split, they left a 15-foot entryway or appendage for the exact purpose of having access to this lot. That, we believe, precludes a preliminary injunction such that our clients don't have their property taken from them. And I'll save the balance.
Please, the court. My name is Robert Hoover, and I represent the appellee plaintiff, Westpac Aspen Investments LLC. Judges, Mr. Bryan has stated we are the appellee in this case, and we are here to ask the court to uphold the trial court's findings and the order granting the preliminary injunction. We believe that based on the fact that none of the evidence presented at the trial court was in any way rebutted by the Hens, that there really is no basis to overturn the injunction. I'd really like to turn our attention to what we believe to be the real focus of the case, which is the merger doctrine. The Hens are contending that a joint tenancy created by Dr. William Yarbrough and his wife destroyed this prescriptive easement that the trial court found had been in existence for 43 years as of 2005, but as of the time of the Yarbrough's marriage, it had been established by at least 9 years. If we take the trial court's finding of 1962 as when the possession period started to run, we'd be looking at 1980 at the point where the easement matured. At that time, Dr. Yarbrough owned what I believe is lot 6, or the Hen lot, as of 1978 when he purchased that. And then he acquired what is now the Westpac lot in 1989. And he owned the Hen lot in fee simple, and he owned the Westpac lot as a joint tenant with his wife. We believe the case law really shows without question that a joint tenancy in this situation would not give rise to a merger. Nothing in the briefs or any of the arguments raised by the Hens has addressed Mrs. Yarbrough's interest in the joint tenancy. If it is presumed that this prescriptive easement was in place as of 1980, when she became a joint tenant in 1989, obviously all of those rights would vest in her as a title holder under joint tenancy, and Dr. Yarbrough would not be able to sever her rights, no matter what he did. At best, under the law as it is now, Dr. Yarbrough could destroy the joint tenancy, creating a tenancy in common, if we follow the principles set forth in the Canterbury case. But I don't think he could do anything to take away Mrs. Yarbrough's rights. So
he could have de facto done that if she had no objection.
If she had no objection, correct.
But if she had an objection, if she said, I want this, he said, I don't want it, then he had no way to force her to do it with the nature of the joint tenancy, right?
I would think that that would be correct. He couldn't require her to do it if she said no, or if she said yes, he couldn't say she could. I think a great way to look at this would be, what if they were to be divorced? Obviously, no longer being married, there would be their following interpersonal matters, but she might not want to be a joint tenant with him. She may want to sever her interest and sell it to somebody else. Or if she sold it to him, then I think a unity of title would happen if she sold it to him in fee upon a divorce. If she sold it to somebody else, the same rights that she acquired in 1989, which would include the prescriptive easement, would then go to the outside third party that she sold it to. They would then have their full interest in that right as well, and therefore there wouldn't be any unity of title with the third party. Likewise, I think it's demonstrative to look at the fact that what if she died? If she died under the rules of joint tenancy, then Dr. Yarbrough Dr. Yarbrough would actually have fee title, just as he did in the other lot, and we would have an extinguishment. But
what if she specifically left it to a child in a will?
If the joint tenancy was broken by that method, then I think whoever she left the property to, assuming she followed what appears to me to be kind of a interesting path that the Canterbury courts laid out for people who want to break their joint tenancies, I think that the same bundle of rights that she came into when she took as a joint tenant would follow through to whoever she left it to, assuming that she met the requirements of getting a severing deed and having somebody hold it aside or wait until after she died.
The longer term consequences, if we were to establish a precedent, then as you are describing, have you thought about how does that affect future cases in which there is a joint tenancy and we have concluded that consistent with your view, we've concluded that the joint tenancy defeats the easement.
In looking at that, and you know, I haven't spent a great deal of time, but have put some thought into it in terms of what's a public policy concept. In looking at the Canterbury case, the stated policy by the Supreme Court obviously is that tenancy in common is now the preferred method of ownership. And if it were to be a situation where a joint tenancy,
it's a merger rather than the easement. Go ahead.
Just so I'm clear, so we're saying that if the joint tenancy does defeat the merger doctrine, and an easement would survive. I just wanted.
Yeah, I'm mixing my attorneys here. Mm-hmm. So your view is that the joint tenancy does not affect a merger.
That's correct. Yeah. That there would be no extinguishment of the easement.
Right.
There is ownership in joint tenancy or tenancy in common or any other form of tenancy where you have this concept of joint ownership of the whole.
Are there any negative consequences on to future scenarios if we go that way?
I don't see negative consequences down the road in terms of protecting people's property interests and looking at the bundles of rights that they receive when they come into title. I would see more problems with the contrary position of, okay, a joint tenancy would defeat this because you would be giving one joint tenant more power over the other joint tenant to destroy a property interest that they purchased.
So you're saying there's negative consequences if we agree with the Hens that the easement is destroyed by a merger?
Yes.
And the negative consequences are, depending on factual scenarios in the future, or the negative consequences are it doesn't matter anymore?
Well, I think that the negative consequence could be shown in an immediate position, because then how do you value somebody? And let's say that hypothetically, we're not talking about married people, we're talking about people who might be buying a ski cottage jointly, families, and they don't create an ownership entity like an LLC like many people do today. You're giving any one of that group of people who may be joint tenants the ability to destroy a right of one of the other joint tenants. assuming that it exists. So if there was an easement for access to another property across that, and you have three joint tenants in a house, and one of the three says, you know, I'm going to sell my interest in and I'm going to, you know, put it on record on my deed that the easement doesn't exist, then he's irreparably damaged his other co-joint tenants. And I think that that would create tremendous problems in all sorts of areas in terms of real estate transactions. And how do you contract around something like that? How would you help your clients or help anybody purchasing real estate where they've got a risk of a right that they have paid good funds for being taken away by somebody else?
So have you had a chance to look around the other jurisdictions, and have you found cases with the identical fact pattern involving a joint tenancy and how they've been decided?
We have not, Your Honor. We have searched nationwide looking for cases involving the merger doctrine and joint tenancy, and we were not able to locate any. We found the cases that we cited in our brief that deal with tenancies in common and tenancies by the entireties, both of which have been held not to extinguish easements because of the separate ownership interest of the other part of the ownership. And looking at it and considering the Canterbury case, there's something kind of descriptive in there, and I'll quote from the Taylor versus Canterbury case, which says, once created, each joint tenant owns a vested interest in the property which cannot be alienated or extinguished without that particular tenant's consent. Now, in the Taylor case at the time, they're citing, I believe it's a Lee versus Graber matter, which is an older case, which Taylor overturned on the concept of needing a straw man to destroy your joint tenancy, which under the Canterbury case now, we don't need that anymore. Somebody can just sever their own interest if they want to, thus creating the tenancy in common. And when you look at that in the context of the cases we've cited, I think the Lacey versus Seegers decision, which is a Florida decision we cited, is very instructive with regards to the thinking that goes into why a tenancy by the entireties doesn't break it. And really, it's the same as a joint tenancy other than the fact that they're a married party, and tenancy by the entireties are only available to married couples in those states that have it. So the analysis is really the same. You can't break off that piece of the wife or the husband's interest in the tenancy and destroy an easement because it would take away that property right that was vested in them when it was purchased or put in that title.
Mr. Brian is saying there's a difference here. In a joint tenancy, there's no fractionalization, if you will. They both are equal owners, whereas in a tenancy in common, it is a fractionalized share. Even if it's 50-50 or 51-49, it's a fractionalized share. Doesn't that make it different if you're a joint owner, that you really have dominion over the entirety?
I don't look at it, Your Honor, in terms of an ownership percentage. If somebody's got 51% and the other tenant in common has 49%, you're still talking about a right that was purchased or received. Whether it was purchased or not, it doesn't really matter. It's still an existing right that somebody else has in your ownership group, and I don't think it's right that it would be terminated by the act of one person or the other. Again, I'll turn back to the Taylor case, and unfortunately I don't have a pinpoint site in front of me, but you know, there's a great discussion of the reason why tenancy in common is really kind of becoming the, you know, favored version under the Supreme Court's eyes to hold ownership of property, which is that there really isn't that much of a difference in terms of ownership of the whole as a joint tenant, or whether somebody theoretically has their fractional share in their tenancy in common.
The only real distinction, the survivorship?
Well, I think so, and I think the Taylor Court goes to explain that, you know, the right of survivorship is not a vested right, as the Supreme Court views it, which is probably the right, and it's consistent with the restatement. So in that situation, it kind of goes afield from dealing with whether or not you're breaking a vested right in terms of a prescriptive easement, but at the same time, it's something that clarifies the difference that there is no right of survivorship of the tenancy in common. If Your Honors, please, I'd like to reserve my time, if I could.
No,
he's the appellant.
You might as well use it.
Okay.
If you have.
I wanted to make a couple of comments with regards to the Hens contention that the concept of continuous use was not satisfied. I think that first and foremost, the trial court's findings are all based on competent evidence, and therefore I don't believe that the appellate court really should go and look into the trial court's findings because they were based on competent evidence. That's the standard that's set forth in the Brown v. Fats case.
But there was no dispute, was there, that there were times when it couldn't have been used and it wasn't used?
Right. But that's also irrelevant to our analysis simply because you don't have to have use all the time. I mean, the Kleiner versus Hartshorn case stands for the proposition, and that's at 89 P3rd 462, that you can have use of an easement intermittently and still maintain your claim for open, notorious, and continuous use. That goes along the lines of also attacking another portion of the Hens argument in terms of the size of what is being claimed in terms of the prescriptive easement. It's really based on the use is how the easement is defined. And again, that's something probably for the trial court to take up after the trial in terms of actually what are the physical parameters of this prescriptive easement that he has found to have existed. In looking at that from the point of view that it would seem like an inordinately large part of this particular property, it's what was there, and it's been there since 1960. It was there before the house that the Hens live in was built, and in fact, what is built now is probably less intrusive to the extent it would be compared to the tramway that used to be up there. In closing, I think that we have established, and we want the appellate court to affirm the trial court's findings that we've met the Rathke factors and that a preliminary injunction should stand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bryan, I'm going to ask you the same question that I had difficulty asking before. What's the consequences if we go your way, and what's the consequences to future joint owners in Ms. Yarborough's posture? I mean, because we're not, if we make this ruling, this would be as a matter of law as to all future joint tenants, that one joint tenant can divest, can alienate the other joint tenant's interest in an easement. So where are we leaving Ms. Yarborough, the future Ms. Yarborough's?
Well, I contend, Your Honor, that the reason we don't see any cases like this around the country is because when this happens, when a man and wife take as joint tenants a dominant estate and the husband himself owns a surveying estate, she's allowed to use that permissively and hence not adversely. So that might be one reason why we don't see these cases arising, except here where we need to establish that for the purpose of extinguishment by merger. Now, as to your question, I believe that this court doesn't need to adopt a overly broad and deep holding that all joint tenancies extinguish any equitable servitudes, whether they be prescriptive easements or other types of servitudes. I'm not contending that. I'm saying that it's what the court should do is not be overly rigid so that they say out of hand, well, because the names on the two titles were not verbatim identical, then we're not going to even entertain the possibility of a merger. That is an overly rigid ruling, and it's what I would ask for is a flexible case-by-case approach that allows for the factual circumstances to be taken into account, but that it does not adopt a unbendable rule that says if the joint tenant is not the same as the sole owner of the serving estate, then no merger whatsoever. I don't think that's in the best interest of the development of the Colorado law.
So how does that case-by-case approach help you here?
It helps me here because there's no proof, and as the movements in the preliminary injunction proceedings, Westpac had the burden of proof to establish adversity, and there was no establishment of adversity for this time period. So that would be yet another argument for why, as to the extinguishment, for the clock to reset, it would have to start over with continuous adverse use, which are the criteria for a prescriptive easement. Now, if that was permissive during that time, if it was not adverse, if Mrs. Yarborough was able to traipse over that part of her husband's property freely and with permission, the prescriptive easement does not start anew. And as to the tenants in common, if a joint tenancy is broken into a tenancy in common, then those co-tenants have the ability to establish adverse use. So no one's rights are taken away. It's just that they cannot rely on the superficial or hypertechnical differences between title when it goes to possession. And that's what the case law talks about, is it does not talk about the identical names. It talks about what's the scope of control, use, and dominion.
Yeah, we're not going to go to the thing where it's just a matter of identical names.
Sure.
But it does matter as to the ownership interest of the different names. And it would seem to me that's an essential consideration. And my question is, assuming for a minute that there was an adverse use up until the Yarbroughs took title to, jointly took title to Lot 6. If there had been an adverse use up until then, and then Ms. Yarbrough had this permissive use across the other, does that still extinguish it just because there was a period of permissive use? Apart from the title, the merger issue, if she just stopped using it, or if a permission were then given after 20 years or whatever it was.
Yes, Your Honor, because we think the need for the prescriptive easement would no longer exist because of that permission. And if you look at the cases that they cite, he talked about Lacey and he talks about Myers in his briefs, and those are estates by the moieties, estate by the entirety, which talks about the undivided moieties. Those are instrumental here because there they held just a portion of the dominant and serving estates, not the whole. And so there you would need to establish permission, and the adversity issue comes back again. So I apologize for those interrelated concepts, but they are important because you have to look at the adversity to determine whether or not the extinguishment should happen.
So let me ask you this. So I own Lot 6, and I've had a permissive easement, or prescriptive easement. I have adversely used Lot 5 for 20 years. And the owner of Lot 5 sells it to you. And now you own it, and now you are aware of that I am using it. You have no objection. Indeed, you tell me you have no objection. Thereafter, can my buyer claim the prescriptive easement on the basis of my 20 years of adverse use?
Your Honor, I'd have to revisit the concepts put forth in Matouche and some others as to answer that question. I'm sorry, I can't give you a better answer.
Very good. Thank you, counsel. This is obviously an unusual case, and a case for which we're all looking for not only precedent, but the right answer. Your arguments have been very helpful. Thank you.